Well, I think we'll go ahead and get started here. Let's leave the door open, let people walk in. But this is the panel on energy versus recreation in the fight for public lands. Just real quickly, introduce everybody. So Corley is down at the end from Patagonia. Whit Fosberg, the CEO of Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. No, oh, sorry. Sorry. Land, honey. It's getting confused already. Of Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. Whit Fosberg of the Teddy Roosevelt Conservation Partnership. Just come on in. And Katie Anders of The Guardian and a Knight Journalism Fellow at MIT. I'm not going to make any sort of big statement at the beginning because I think we'll just get right into it. It's sort of an unprecedented time right now with public lands, as we all sort of know. And lots of sort of bills coming up, lots of reviews happening right now of previous policies. And I think one of the biggest ones to begin with is the monument review, which is has happened. I'm hoping, Corley, you can sort of give a quick overview of that and where it stands right now. We're still waiting for the sort of final decision from the administration. But I sort of have the question of where that's at, sort of why it came up. And the sort of bigger question of how the outdoor industry has come together a little bit to try and protect some of these monuments who seem to be very much in danger.
Okay. Hi. Thanks for organizing this. Good morning, everybody. So when President Trump came into office pretty soon after, he asked Secretary Zinke to review monuments that were over 100,000 acres in size going back 20 years, three presidents. So Zinke started that review in the late spring. Over the course of the review, he took a handful off. There are 21 remaining, but the fact that there's even one, I think, is an insult to people who love public lands, wild places. So the monument review period started with a public comment period. And, you know, it's our feeling now that we've gone through that, that the whole thing was kind of a sham. It's laughable that years, in many cases decades worth of work, could be decided over 4 months. But we at Patagonia, the outdoor industry, and all of our nonprofit partners took it really seriously and got out a lot of comments in that. I mean, there were almost 3 million comments submitted, 98% of which were in favor of keeping monument protections in place. But nonetheless, Zinke appears to have totally disregarded those comments and submitted a secret memo that was really vague and full of a lot of inaccuracies. That memo was later leaked to the Washington Post and Wall Street Journal. And now we're just in this really dangerous limbo period. We haven't heard anything from the White House. The Department of Interior refers everything to the White House. They're not commenting on it. There's some rumors that Trump might act by the end of this month. I don't put a lot of stock in those rumors because there have been a lot of rumors along the way in this process. But we know that according to this memo, this leaked memo, that there are four monuments that are in serious danger, 10 that the protections are really going to be dismantled. And I just one last thing on this. This is really dangerous. I mean, in a place like Bears Ears, the Department of Interior, it's one of our most newly established monuments, the Department of Interior won't touch it right now because they're waiting on its status. And Bears Ears needs a management plan. And so every day that it goes without a management plan is a day that it could get looted, destroyed, and really just severely damaged. So, you know, we're trying to keep the level of awareness of these issues up. Really grateful to our partners who have also been really vocal. And yeah, that's where it stands. Is there anything else you want me to add to that?
Well, I guess I'll sort of turn a question over to Land a little bit with that. Is that you guys have weighed in quite a bit, very vocally, sort of aggressively, fighting back. And teaming up with the outdoor industry, sort of you represent hunters and anglers, which isn't a group that's typically associated with sort of the more environmental groups that have been out there, which sort of Patagonia represents in some ways. And I'm sort of curious your guys' perspective on the monument review as well, because it's been positioned that they're, you know, the review is up for more access for hunters and anglers, but that was also built into the process of creating these monuments in a lot of cases.
Thanks. I think that the access piece is really just smoke and mirrors, really. And I think the intent was to attack the Antiquities Act. You know, the Antiquities Act has been around since 1906, been used by, you know, eight Republicans, eight Democrats, and really, you know, the folks I think that were pushing this just don't like the Antiquities Act. And so we looked at this. There's a place called the Upper Missouri Breaks in Montana, which when it came into become a monument, it was not done without controversy, but there was a lot of support for it as well. And now it's like the best place to hunt elk, bighorn sheep, and mule deer in Montana. It's a very coveted place. It's one of the ones that Mr. Zinke took off took off doing any kind of monkeying around with right from the beginning, because he knew that he'd have a revolution on his hands in Montana. And so we looked at, though, that any kind of reduction is really, it's an attack on one, is an attack on them all. And while you have a place like the Upper Missouri Breaks, which is very special to us in Montana, but also to everybody in America, he takes that off, you know, from being monkeyed around with. Well, you mess around with one, what's to say the next administration is not going to do something to that monument at a different time? And, you know, you look at Oregon Mountains, Desert Peaks down in New Mexico. I've hunted quail down there. It's phenomenal. It has not only good quail hunting, but also some artifacts that are being protected. And, you know, that was brought on by hunters. And, you know, we've got a report that's out at the coffee tables, and it's like monuments that the sportsman's perspective. And we did that with the Theodore Roosevelt Conservation Partnership and a bunch of other brands, as well as other sportsman partners. And really, like, these are places that we love to hunt and fish. And I think this review really is I think it's a slap in the face to anybody that likes public lands. And I think we'll see what the ultimate thing is here. But what is really going to, I think that what's going to, something that stood the test of time now is going to become a political football. And it'll be passed back and forth between administration back to administration. And that, I think, is the most frustrating piece about this whole thing.
Can I ask you a quick question, Land? Yeah. So as somebody from Montana, I'm just curious if, I thought it was interesting that in Zinke's memorandum to the president, he also included the potential for an establishment of a new national monument,
sure,
or two, mm-hmm, one of them being in Montana.
Yep.
You know, your perspective as a Montana, do you think that is playing to his constituency? Do you think that's, like, it was just notable to me that it was just, you know, it happened to be.
Yeah, I think it's a good question. I think that, so she's talking about Badger II Medicine in Montana, very special place in the Rocky Mountain front. That's where the creation story was for the Blackfeet. It's great cutthroat trout fishing, even better than what we had, I think. And so while he's talking about, you know, reducing, let's say, bear's ears, and then at the same time talking about maybe a new monument in Montana, like, you're kind of talking on both sides of your mouth there. And for me, it's like, how can you be going after the Antiquities Act, really, and then at the same time saying you want to permanently protect something? Well, now that you're messing around with the Antiquities Act, it quite frankly would probably not be permanently protected. Like, you have to look for a different way to protect that landscape. So I think he's pandering to Montana constituents, and that's why he left Upper Missouri Breaks alone, and that's why he's talking about Badger II Medicine. And quite frankly, it's because he wants to come back and probably run for governor or senator. And, like, he knows that if he makes those moves in Montana, those are things that will follow him around until he, you know, no longer is with us.
And Whit, I'd love for you to weigh in a little bit too, because I feel like the TRCP almost, you work in D.C., you work with a lot of the sort of the politicians on issues like this, and sort of what's it been like with this monument review for you guys? Have they been open to suggestions about what's going on, and sort of you know, again, just your take on it from the D.C. side of things?
Yeah, no, I think that the administration has been very unopen to any sort of input. I mean, I think the, you know, public review process was a total sham. And basically, even Zinke claimed, you know, said it was a sham in his memo to the White House, saying that, you know, this was like an orchestrated effort. Like, absolutely, it was an orchestrated effort. We worked really hard to get a lot of comments going into the White House. And, so that's how it works. And when you're out, you know, done 98-2, you know, I'd say we did a pretty darn good job with that. So I think that was a total sham. I think they've been, you know, there's been zero interest on the part of Interior really to listen to this, you know, these concerns. Now, there have been instances in the past where monument designations have not gone well for hunters and anglers. I'll go back to the, you know, original marine designation around Hawaiian Islands where George W. Bush specifically did not allow recreational fishing. You know, there was no science about that, just wasn't allowed. But in all the ones that are being reviewed here, hunting and fishing is taken care of. It is a, you know, it is an issue. It is intentionally raised to divide the hunting and fishing community from the broader outdoor rec community. And remember, this is, you know, we talk about permanent protection, but, you know, Congress can go back in and do whatever it wants with these monuments. I mean, a lot, and Congress has done that in the past, has gone in and changed monuments to national parks. And if Rob Bishop has an issue with bear's ears, you know, he ought to pass legislation to make it the way he wants it. But I think anybody who knows has followed that story from the beginning was that Rob Bishop was not exactly sincere about wanting legislation to deal with this in the first place. He would rather have a train wreck with the Antiquities Act because that serves his broader long-term political agenda.
Well, and I think that's what's interesting here is there's been a lot of bills introduced this Congress with public lands. You know, one was essentially going to sell off a number of lands, and it was always unclear whether that bill stood a chance. It eventually got scuttled, but now there's another one coming up. That's the Federal Land Freedom Act that I'm hoping you can sort of describe briefly. It seems to be a similar vein, which is essentially going to turn over some lands potentially to the states for the specific purpose of oil and gas extraction.
Yeah, so those of you who followed the public lands issue the last few years, there was sort of a rising tide of getting rid of public lands altogether to balance the budget or whatever, or transfer them to the states, which is code for get rid of the public lands because most of the states can't afford to manage them. And I think that, you know, Lands Group, our group, National Wildlife Federation, a few others, really the hunting and fishing community, you know, hit that hard. And you saw that when Jason Chaffetz withdrew H.R. 621, which would have sold off 3.3 million acres. I mean, Chaffetz was dressed in camo, holding this misbegotten-looking hunting dog, and basically said he was sorry and was going to withdraw his bill. And so I think what you're seeing now is a change of tactic for the folks who are fundamentally anti-public lands. Instead of outright disposal, because they've lost that battle for the time being, it's chipping away around the edges. And the bill you're talking about would essentially transfer all authorities for mineral, oil and gas permitting and development to the states. And so it's really the best of all worlds for the states. I mean, they would get, you know, revenues. They could guide it. Feds would have to foot the bill. And, oh, by the way, it would be all of a sudden not subject to NEPA or the Endangered Species Act doing any of this development. We see, you know, Chaffetz had another bill and that would have basically turned over federal law enforcement authority on public lands to deputized local officials, which basically means there would be no, you know, law enforcement on federal lands. So I think you're going to see the battle change now to the head-on assault, to the chipping away at the edges, getting rid of the authorities, cutting back the budgets so the agencies can't do their jobs. We talk about the maintenance backlog. You look at the Forest Service fire problem where the agency is spending more than half its budget fighting fires. Yeah, it's no wonder they have 1,800 campgrounds that are closed on the Forest Service lands. So that is the kind of battle I think we're shifting to. I mean, Land, you may have, you know, additional perspectives on this.
No, I think one of the things to be clear about is that, you know, when Roosevelt started this public lands legacy that we had, that was not done with applause, you know? I mean, they put him on Mount Rushmore, but there were senators from Montana and Wyoming and Idaho that stopped him from doing that. And that's why he had to do the, you know, 21 Midnight Forests. And so this idea of sale comes up every 10 or 15 years, and it's never going to go away. But I think now that you are right, that they're changing tactics. And, you know, I think it sounds like better to the public, but at the end of the day, it's probably even more dangerous.
And I'm going to sort of turn this question a little bit to like, how do you cover this sort of thing? Because it does seem to be a lot of signaling to the base with these bills, right? And so they may not be introducing these bills with the express purpose of getting them passed. It's more sort of it's again signaling to the base. So I'd love for you, Katie, to sort of weigh in on what challenges you see with covering these sorts of issues.
Yeah. So at the Guardian this past winter and spring, we did a bunch of coverage of public land issues and saw, you know, a real resonance with our readership around this idea of public land transfer. You know, these stories really got people interested. Readership was long on these pieces. They were widely shared. I think those stories were in some respects easier to tell, those transfer stories, because it's this straightforward narrative, like these lands are federally managed for mixed use. You essentially own them. They are going to be transferred to the states where, you know, we have the data that shows that 70% of land transferred to the states gets sold off and privatized. So we were able to tell the story saying, you know, there's this thing that's mixed use, that's public access, that everybody has access to. It is on the chopping block, essentially. The challenge, I think, now with telling these same environment stories that essentially amount to the same thing with, like, the Federal Land Freedom Act, which is quite the name to remember and to explain to people. You know, you haven't seen the coverage of that act that you did around H.R. 621 and 622 because it's more challenging. You have to explain what it means to, to pass over oil and gas management to the states. There's another layer of explanation that needs to go into these stories. But if you can get there, they amount to the same thing to your readership. They amount to land transfer, provided you can frame and tell those stories in a rigorous and compelling way. So I think that's the challenge that exists for journalists as this sort of fight evolves. And I think, there are lots of different ways you can get there. I guess I can wait to talk about that.
Do you want to wait?
Yeah,
I mean, just a couple of comments on some of the motivations behind putting these bills in and some of the subtleties involved. I mean, first of all, the motivations are, it's a marker bill for the base. Two, it's a payback for political donors that are supporting them to, push this kind of thing. But three, and this is what we saw with the federal land transfer issue, it is an issue of making it a mainstream, talking point. And what once was a kooky idea of getting rid of public lands, I mean, it seemed kooky when, the Sagebrush Rebellion was going on and, things like that. Over time becomes mainstream. You see it in the Republican Party platform. You see it with, Ted Cruz proposing getting rid of all the public lands. And so, again, if you put this stuff out there, you talk about it enough, it becomes part of the common dialogue, and that's the danger. And, what's wrong with the state supervising it? They're right there. But the issue is, exemptions from all the public lands, the fact that we're still footing the bills, but they don't have to abide by our laws, and the fact that these are public lands that are managed for everybody, and you're changing to a single use as opposed to multiple use. And, that's a much more difficult story to tell. Same way with, let's transfer the lands to the states. We love the states. States do a great job managing fish and wildlife. But that's basically code for getting rid of these lands long term. So there's a subtlety of dealing with this, understanding what the long term motivation about making this a mainstream topic of conversation. And with the public land transfer, you saw ALEC get involved with drafting model legislation that was going to all the states to sell off those lands. You saw the creation of a dedicated nonprofit, the Public Lands Council or American Lands Council, whatever it was, that did nothing but promote this idea and make it mainstream. So you're dealing with sort of a very small subset of well-moneyed interests that are claiming to represent a broad movement. There is no movement. This is a bunch of well industries trying to make this mainstream.
And to more sort of maybe continue on that thread, Corley, these interests are sort of saying that oil and gas money creates jobs, and that's sort of a common talking point that they turn to. But the recreation economy is pretty huge, and I'm sort of curious how that stacks up against the oil and gas industry, particularly out west where there's lots of public lands that people recreate on.
Sure. So the outdoor recreation industry creates more jobs and more revenue than the oil and gas industry. And I think there's been, along the lines of what Whit was just saying, just a lot of misinformation out there about this. And the good news is that some of these monuments that are under review, because they were established 20 years ago, there's now a lot of good economic data that shows how helpful they are to local communities. Look no further than the local Chamber of Commerce near Grand Staircase Escalante, which has become the biggest advocate of that monument. We know that incomes are higher in communities that are closer to public lands. So there's lots of great proof points. There's just also a lot of misinformation out there about it.
I think, that $887 billion it's number three in this country, right? You have the financial sector and you have the kind of medical sector, and outdoor economy is number three. And for some reason, it's looked at like it's not as important. And, you know, not only is it like sustainable if you take care of these public lands, but it's something that you can grow. And so to me, when we're talking about jobs and the economy, like that's something we need to pay attention to. And then there's a lot of conversations about rural economies. You know, I know as a hunter, when you go to these rural economy or rural communities during the hunting season, it's like Christmas for 3 or 4 months for them. I mean, they get this influx of people. There's a lot of money that's exchanged hands there. And without that, I don't know where those communities are going to be. So I think the public lands, they understand the importance of those public lands and you know, the outdoor economy that goes with it.
I mean, it's also important not to just, you know, dismiss the value of oil and gas and energy as well. I mean, those are really important in certain areas, and I think we're doing ourselves a disservice when we sort of, you know, pit just one against the other. Technology has changed incredibly in the last, you know, 20 years. I mean, you look at a picture of the, you know, the Jonah Field in Wyoming, which is basically quarter-acre pads as far as the eye can see. They can develop that same area with probably one-tenth of the footprint that they used to. And that's a story that's not being told, too, that you can have both if you're smart about it. And to the Obama administration's credit, they developed something called master lease planning, which is an idea of going into whole areas and looking at where we're going to develop, how we're going to develop it, where the road's going to go, where the pipeline's going to go, where are we going to protect, you know, where are we not going to do any development, where are we going to do minimal development. I mean, that's the way it needs to be done. And too often this is framed as all, you know, monuments every place, lock it all up, or nothing, which is rape and ruin. And that's really not the story either. I mean, there are certain places that got to be protected. There are a lot of other places that you can have both if you do it smart. But there's not even the acknowledgement right now coming out of Interior about doing it smart. It's all about energy dominance and getting rid of any impediments to more oil and gas development. Well, the main impediment to oil and gas development is the price of oil and gas. And that's often not cited as either.
Yeah, I think when I just want to reiterate, like when you said earlier, when it goes from multiple use to single use is when we get in trouble, right? These public lands are set aside for multiple use. And so you have places that need to be protected, but you have places that, you know, development can happen done in the right way. I mean, look at the fight that's going to go on around the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. They set aside the North Slope to develop oil, and then the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge is kind of like on the other side of that. And so now you're going back on that compromise, and it threatens, you know, one of the most special places in this country.
Why isn't the outdoor recreation industry sort of better represented in D.C. if the money is there?
So I think we're getting better at this. We certainly don't pay our lobbyists probably as well as the oil and gas industry. But I do think we're getting better. And if there's been one silver lining on this monument review and just the general issue of public lands this year, I think it's that the outdoor industry, the hunting and fishing industries have come together and they have shown that they can be a force. That was, you know, what we demonstrated in the public comment period. That is why there have been so many great stories on this in rural, urban, national, local, all different kinds of media outlets. And I do think that's the result of the industry stepping up. They realized now. I don't think Zinke knew he was going to wake the sleeping giant, but and we were admittedly probably sleepier than we should have been. But I think we're awake now. And I'll say, too, I think we're not afraid. And Patagonia, at the beginning of the year, sort of led this movement to move the Outdoor Retailer Trade Show out of Utah. And so we did that in January. We did a call with the leaders of the North Face, REI, and Outdoor Industry Association with Governor Herbert from Utah. The result of that was to move the show because Governor Herbert was not willing to change his position and speak out in support for public lands. And so we're excited to go to Denver, and they're definitely still mad at us in Salt Lake City.
Yeah, in terms of the economic clout of the outdoor industry, I think that's going to change moving forward as well, because last year something passed Congress called the REC Act, and it directed the Department of Commerce to look, you know, basically report on the outdoor recreation economy the same way it reports on agriculture, you know, home sales, all the rest of that stuff. So for the first time, beginning, I think, next year, you know, we will actually have official numbers coming out of D.C. about this sector, which will put it on much more of a level footing, you know, with the other sort of industrial sectors in this country, and give us much more better, you know, give us much better, you know, data, as well as more, you know, just sort of recognition within the Beltway.
And Len, maybe you can talk real quickly about this issue as well, because it was almost a divide and conquer strategy for a while with the outdoor recreation industry. Hunters and anglers were always sort of separated from outdoor enthusiasts, hikers, mountain bikers, whatever it was. And maybe you sort of talk about how that has specifically played out with your group.
Sure. I mean, I'll go back to Cora Lee. You know, I mean, I think hunters and anglers have been working on conservation, you know, for over 130 years. If you look at the history, and it's, you know, it starts with Roosevelt and the Boone and Crockett Club, but I mean, that's something that's played out in this country. Any kind of environmental fight, hunters and anglers have been involved in it. And I think that this emerging kind of human powered, so the kayakers and the mountain bikers and the mountain climbers, like, that's something that's new, because that is kind of, those are new things anyways. And so I think, you know, there's this idea maybe that we don't agree on things. I think we agree on like 98% probably of stuff together. And so it's more, I think, something that's been made up to try to split us. And, you know, it really comes down to, you know, you can't care about the environment and care about guns. And I think that, you know, that is changing. It has changed in the last decade. Nobody's, you know, I don't think a lot of sportsmen are worried about anybody coming to their house and taking their guns away. And so they're starting to really be able to think about conservation more, especially when they vote. And to me, that's a good change. And then I think with Cora Lee talking about the silver line, it's absolutely the truth. You know, I mean, if you look at history in this country, every time there's something that's bad going on, that was market killing going on in the early 1900s, and they, you know, made laws that you couldn't sell wild game anymore. We had the Dirty 30s when the lid's coming off the prairie. Then you get, you know, Pittman-Robertson Act, which takes money from guns and ammunition to put that back in conservation, or the duck stamp at that point. Then you get into the 60s, you know, and rivers are on fire, and we get, you know, Clean Air and Clean Water Act, the Wilderness Act. Like, all these bad things have always generated something good. And so I think in these times we're in right now, like, that silver lining is this kind of unification. And that unification, I think, was there, but this is making it happen in a much more real way, and I think in a long-lasting way. And I do think that the unification, you know, we're going to go through some tough times, and we're not going to win everything, but boy, man, when we come out of this, I think we're going to be much stronger.
One of the things that's been really interesting about covering public land issues in the last 9 months for me has been sort of getting outside of talking to the same sort of environmental groups, same conservation groups on the same, you know, land, water, oil issues. I talked to a member of BHA for a story who described membership in your group as neckers and guys with dreads yelling at the same politician, which is, you know, it's actually kind of exciting as a journalist to find an area of coverage these days where that's somewhat bipartisan. It's really interesting to see these small areas where people are fighting for issues and not political parties. So that's been interesting for me.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point. And yeah, we did a national sportsman's poll that we released at the Western Governors Association meeting this summer, where we just, a Republican polling firm, Lori Weigel with Public Opinion Strategies, and it surveyed 1,000 sportsmen, 100 are fished, around the country. And there was no difference between, you know, Republicans, Democrats, independents, Trump voters, Clinton voters. It didn't matter when you talked about public lands, clean water, funding for conservation, sage grouse. We went a little bit granular with the survey. And, you know, but there was, you know, this should never be a partisan issue with our community. And, you know, the opponents of conservation will always try to make it a partisan issue. And they're trying to do that, divide even the hunting community with the whole monuments issue, claiming that this is, you know, monuments are an attempt to block access, which a lot of the knee-jerk kind of reaction is, wow, gosh, we can't have that. But without bothering to check that access is fully provided in all these monuments that are being reviewed. So, I mean, that sort of divide and conquer strategy is still going on, even though I think our community is actually very united if they just talk about the issues and the facts, and there is no divide on this.
And I will say that there's a lot of reviews coming up beyond the Monuments Review. There's one, the Sage Grouse Review, for example, which is another seemingly well thought out, well reasoned sort of compromise between lots of interest groups to prevent the sage grouse from going on the endangered species list. But now it's up for review again, and it seems like that it's going to change, like the Monument Review. And I'm hoping, Witt and Land, if you could sort of weigh in quickly with what that's about and why we're there again now when this was a very – it was decades in the making plan.
Yeah, I mean, just a little review if you haven't studied the sage grouse. Unlike the Wall Street Journal article that ran this week, this is not a flightless bird. This is a bird that actually flies and gets into trouble when it runs into fences and things. But it's a, you know, it's sort of iconic species that is significantly down from its historic, you know, numbers. But we're not in a situation where this, you know, triage. We're still probably somewhere in the ballpark of 500,000 birds, covers an area of about 70 million acres. And basically the courts ordered the Department of the Interior to come together and decide whether this, you know, bird is warranted for listing under the Endangered Species Act or not. After a multi-year effort, it really was led by the state of Wyoming to a certain degree under Dave Friedenfall, the former governor, and now more recently Matt Mead, you know, that really pulled the industry, oil and gas, wind. Wind is a big problem. Sage grouse, they're only real predators, come from the air, eagles, other raptors. So anything that's tall around, they will avoid it. So they don't go anywhere near where there's a power line, where there's a windmill, where there's an oil derrick, anything like that. So that's why, you know, this is a big deal. But they also came to got the grazers together, the sportsmen, because it's a very, you know, coveted sporting species, environmentalists, and they came up with a plan to basically prevent that listing. And in September of 2015, 16, Dan Ash announced that, you know, they were not going to list it because of the strength of this plan. Now, you know, Zinke comes in and actually, the issue is not doing the review. I think the review is entirely appropriate. You have something that is this big, that covers 70 million acres, you know, 98 different BLM plans. I think it's entirely appropriate to go in and do a review because there are certain things that, you know, could get tweaked to make it work better here and there. The problem is that these guys have not seen a review yet that doesn't sort of look like it's rolling back everything. In particular, when they announced the review, they talked about, you know, basically blocking oil and gas development. Now, oil and gas was in the room when these plans were cut. Not everybody got everything they wanted. You know, the radical environmentalists, you know, sued on this. You know, the radical oil and gas industry sued on this as well. And, but now the Zinke administration seems to be taking the side that, you know, somehow oil and gas and other developers got screwed in this deal and they've reopened it. Now, we don't know exactly what this is going to look like down the road when the review is done. The good thing we have going for us on this is that we have the states, you know, led by Wyoming and a conservative Republican governor, pushing back hard on any sort of major, you know, changes to these plans because so much went into this. You know, John Hickenlooper, Democratic governor of Colorado, is doing the same thing. Western Governors Association as a whole has been great on this issue. It has basically saved our bacon from, you know, wholesale changes. But we don't know what this review is going to look like. They just did a notice of intent on Friday to basically formally open all those plans up and, you know, look at changes. It doesn't necessarily mean that changes are going to be made, but it well could be, and we're very concerned about what that might look like down the road and what that means for any sort of future collaboration on the Endangered Species Act. I mean, why would everybody go through the time, 10 years of getting together to work out an agreement like this, just to have it scuttled on the next administration for political reasons?
Yeah, the only thing I would add is that this isn't just about sage grouse either. It's about the habitat. You know, it's a sage steppe habitat that is host to 348, I think, other species, mule deer and pronghorn. I mean, these are very important areas for that landscape. And I think, you know, I would reiterate what he just said is that whether that's around, you know, collaboration on the ESA or just collaboration in general, when people sit down at the table and they look each other across, you know, a table for over a decade, and they don't get everything they want, but they find a compromise, why would they do that anywhere else on any other issue? I mean, I think that one is that, I mean, besides the bird, I think that's the biggest thing at stake here is that, you know, then you get these situations where only one side wins and becomes this pendulum that swings back and forth, right? Like, we want these things to last the test of time, and that's what compromise is. And so, you know, I think, you know, I look at this, And Witt has more faith in this process than I do. I mean, I look at this. I mean, we're talking about the sale of public lands. Like, this is not like we're not selling those lands, but we're selling them out, right? And you know, I don't want access to a place that is an industrial landscape. And I think that's what's going on with the Monuments Review, and that's going on with the Sage Grouse Review as well, is it's a sell out.
Well, that sort of brings up the interesting question, sort of between the two of you, Land and Whit. You know, Whit, you work in D.C. pretty regularly with the politicians, right? Like, at one point, do you need to criticize, or do you always sort of work with them? And sort of a similar question for you, Land. I mean, you sort of have done a good job of kind of being outside D.C. and being very vocal about these things. You know, so at what point do you stop kind of, you know, being in the room with them and really criticizing them?
Well, I mean, that's the fundamental problem of our community, of the hunting and fishing community, by our community, is we're, you know, historically we've been much more interested in being in the room than actually accomplishing things. And, you know, and so we've, you know, listen, I've been plenty critical of Zinke. I mean, New York Times, Huffington Post, NPR, a bunch of other places, and that's gotten noticed over there. But at the same time, you know, I think, you know, they did a very good, you know, executive order on access that came out, which is a big deal for the hunting and fishing community, and we praise that. So, I mean, if they do good stuff, you know, I think our community in general, at least the ones that are more interested in conservation than politics, will be out there and they'll say good things about them to do something good, and they'll say bad things about them to do something bad. I mean, this can't be personal, and we have to deal with Republicans, we have to deal with Democrats, and, you know, so, I mean, our bottom line is we just keep it based on the issues, and we don't have a PAC, we're not going to endorse any candidates. And we got to work with these guys. So we're going to give them every benefit of the doubt to do the right thing, but we're not going to hesitate from criticizing when it's due.
Are you pro the Big Buck Hunter arcade game that was installed?
I'm all in on Big Buck Hunter.
I would like somebody to find out how much that cost.
Yeah,
it's $500 a day to rent.
To rent?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's probably cheaper to buy.
In case you're unaware of what we're talking about.
I'll finish with Buck Hunter here in a big Sorry. Game, whatever, big yeah. Buck Hunter in a second. I mean, I think for us, like, you know, it is being vocal. And I think sportsmen for a long time have, you know, wanted to be in those closed rooms. And quite frankly, they criticize Democrats very easily. And that the Republicans kind of been off limits. And I think that is changing. I think that's changing because people are standing up for the resource. And so being vocal, I mean, I think, you know, I think the question, like, when do you stop kind of working with them? Well, you can't stop working with them. You know, that's that who is in charge and entrusted in managing these public lands and the 640 million acres that belongs to all of us. And so we have to work with them. But I think outside pressure, I mean, the squeaky wheel still gets the grease in this country, right? And so we talked about the Chaffetz example. That wasn't because he woke up in a week and was like, oh, maybe that was a bad idea. It was because huge public pressure and mostly on Instagram. And you know, I mean, I think when he acquiesced, he used the hashtag keep it public. Well, keep it public is not something he came up with. That's what was coming after him. And so I think that pressure still works. Big Buck Hunter, I mean, I will tell you to the non-hunting public, I mean, it's you can shoot 3 or 4 elk in like one sitting. You have opportunities to shoot prairie dogs, you know, and like hundreds of prairie dogs in your bonus round. Like, I just, like, it's not conservation. Like, when he talks about, like, that going into, you know, Department of Interior, and this is about conservation. That's not what that game is about at all. It's about shooting animals. And I have a 9-year-old daughter, and we go to the local burger joint. We play that game, and she loves it. But I would say that is not conservation.
Yeah, and I should clarify, in case you're unaware of what we're referring to here, Secretary Zinke put a video game, Big Buck Hunter, in the, what was it, the cafeteria. Yeah, and that was the outreach to the hunting and fishing community. So sort of surrounding this topic in terms of how to report on it, I have a question for you, Katie, of there seems to be a lot of closed-door meetings now. There seems to be a lot of concern with federal workers, BLM workers, to not talk to journalists right now. There is a clear sort of disruption of the sort of normal journalistic process here and how you can report some of these stories. And so I'm hoping you can just talk a little bit about some of the challenges of working on these stories, how to get around them if you can, and also sort of the larger question that we all have right now as journalists, which is how do you kind of pay for some of this stuff, right? Like, it's these are issues that are important, that there are lots of people interested in, but sometimes there's just not the resources within a within a publishing company to always dive into them.
So one of the things that we have been doing in covering public lands at The Guardian is outreach to Western publications that are smaller, maybe don't have the reach that we have, but have the on-the-ground reporters, have the reporters that have the background and the context to get in sort of in a local way. So we've been partnering with High Country News a bit, continue to be interested in partnering with other Western publications. And that sort of is looking at both, you know, a resource is dealing with resource problems and also dealing with, you know, expertise problems and access issues. You know, you want people with relationships. I think it's one of the things that's really difficult about editing environment stories these days. So many people are generalists that they don't necessarily have the contacts or the background to tell these stories quickly. So that's why I think for national outlets, partnerships can be extremely useful to get into sort of specific issues. Also, in terms of ways that we want to tell these stories, I mean, I haven't seen a lot of FOIA work done around the Department of the Interior, the Department of Agriculture. You're starting to see a lot of it with ProPublica and the Times around the EPA. Is anybody, how many people in this room have filed a FOIA request? So a lot of you, which is great. I don't know if folks like Muckrock, I do. I just submitted some FOIAs around the Department of the Interior. I'm off this year on a fellowship, so I can't use those. So feel free to look at what I'm putting up on FOIA. I like Muckrock if you want to, you know, circulate and make those requests available. I think through collaboration is really the only way this issue is going to get covered comprehensively, because there just aren't enough people doing it. And that's a huge advantage as journalists. I mean, in a lot of ways, like, you don't have to worry about getting scooped on public land stories, because there probably aren't a lot of people in line to do them. But there should be, because people really care. I think what was cool about doing the series after doing a lot of other sort of environment series is to see how many people sort of came out to read this stuff. Reddit approached us to do an AMA around public lands. They said afterwards that it was one of the most successful ones they've done. They're building a whole deck around it, whatever that means. But you don't see that a lot with environment stories, those sort of like getting to the top of Reddit and bringing all these people out. So keep that in mind when you're pitching these stories or commissioning these stories. They really do see amazing readership. And also because of that, you know, these can be sort of series that can be self-funded, reader-funded. That's what we did for our public land series. We did a reader call-out and asked for donations to do our public land series. But there are also foundations who have been interested in coming in after the fact, advertisers who are interested in you know, getting on board with some of the popularity of this public lands coverage. So keep that in mind if you're managing or editing in a newsroom. You know, there are creative ways to get around the problems of funding environmental journalism. If you can frame them in the, you know, Michael Pollan, Ann Carson, you know, these are stories that potentially can resonate in ways that really change things. So
you want to go ahead?
I think one of the challenges about covering this administration is going to be its fundamental distrust of what it refers to as the deep state. And it is, you know, so I mean, for those of you who watched Martin Heinrich's interview with John Roos or the BLM, you know, about the monument, you know, sort of his, you know, the monument decisions in New Mexico, I mean, it was very telling in that Roos basically said, yep, and Heinrich was pointing out all the factual inaccuracies that were, you know, ladled throughout these two monument reviews for New Mexico. And Roos basically said, we were never contacted. We, you know, provided some input early on. We never saw a final draft. And basically, I think that's what you're going to be seeing a lot of places. You know, the folks that are dealing with these issues on the ground on a day-to-day basis are completely cut out of the decision chain here. And, by the way, you know, there is a, you know, a strong sense within the department about, you know, sort of, you know, whacking back individuals who talk out of turn. Everyone's familiar with Joel Clement, who went from the climate change guy at Interior to royalty revenues, and then just this past week quit the department. You're going to see a lot of other people. There's already been one round of basically these movements of senior executive folks that has been, you know, far more prohibitive and punitive, I would say, than we've seen in previous administrations. The whole idea about moving the headquarters of BLM, you know, from D.C. to the state is, you know, part of breaking up that deep state. And, you know, so I think that you're going to have a much harder time, you know, finding sources who either are knowledgeable because they're being cut out or willing to talk because of the punitive nature of what they've seen so far within the department.
When you talk about them sort of leaving, though, I'm sort of curious if there's any sort of strategy. I mean, are they free to talk once they leave? Are you seeing that on your side? I'm sort of just in thinking about people working on stories like this. Like, how would you suggest approaching them or finding people who are willing to, like, actually give real information?
I mean, I think the folks that leave will sing like canaries. I mean, you know, Joel Clements certainly has, and I think other people will too. But a lot of these folks just can't afford to leave out of principle. I mean, they got families, they got to pay mortgages, and, you know, so I think you're going to probably find people that be very willing to talk, but they're going to do it on deep background and be very protective of not getting called out and not having a paper trail lead back to them that's going to get them fired or shifted to, you know, royalties or Nome, Alaska or someplace like that. So I think it's just going to be much more difficult to get folks to go on record on this stuff who are still within the department.
No offense to Nome, right?
And Katie, I want to follow up with you very quickly with the Guardians Public Land series and just sort of how it came together, because I think a lot of times in a newsroom, you sort of do what the leaders sort of tell you to do. Basically, it's a lot of top-down approach, but the way that the public lands issue came up at the Guardian was very organic. In other words, there was a story that got a lot of traction that then led to another story. And I'm sort of, you know, wondering if you can just describe that process and what it was like to sort of see the response from readers once they started coming up.
Yeah. So I guess our public land series came about based on a couple of stories we did around land transfer that just sort of went off the charts. They were our most read stories for the week. And this is globally, like, this is, you know, these are big stories and, you know, some of them were really small stories. So I think, you know, those were stories that were commissioned around a series that didn't involve land transfer or public land issues by and large. So if you're here, you're interested in these issues, you can shoehorn them in to other areas if editors aren't you know, don't have the background to understand sort of what's going on with threats to public lands. So I was fortunate in getting this series off the ground that there was just enough energy behind it that, you know, it was sort of undeniable that this was something that resonated. It you know, made its way to states that we don't normally hit in the country. It you know, through its own momentum, it created space for more environmental coverage, which was really cool to see. So,
and I guess I'll just sort of double down on that. I mean, I work for Men's Journal, which is not necessarily an issues publication when it comes to this sort of stuff. But I threw up a story online that did extremely well in it, and there was nobody that would sort of said that we needed to cover this. It was just something that a couple of us wanted to do, frankly, within the organization, put it up, saw the response, and then we were off and running with sort of then the motivation and also sort of the free hand to go do this stuff, because we saw it was gaining traction online. And again, I think it doesn't need to be necessarily a top down approach. If you're interested in this and have a smart idea, I think there's ways to show that there are people interested in this subject.
Just to pile on. So I've been head of communications for Patagonia for a year and a month. And not because of me, but because of this issue, we've actually seen more coverage of our company's advocacy for public lands this year. And I think there's a lot of reasons for that. We have been particularly vocal. We have a president that's a lightning rod. And, you know, we've been working on this issue for 40 years, and now it's kind of at the fore, and so it was a great combination of things. But the stories that have, for us at least, that have been the most popular, most shared, have definitely been on this topic, and I haven't had a problem yet calling a reporter to talk them through this and getting them interested. It's been, thanks to all of you, like, there's been a great partnership, I think, with the media on this topic.
And I guess sort of I'm going to turn it over to questions here in a second, but maybe sort of an outstanding question for everybody on this panel. There's clearly going to be a lot of issues coming around this sort of general issue of public lands, and I'm curious if you guys have any stories, frankly, coming around the bend that you might, or issues coming around the bend that you might think would make for good stories.
Well, I'm just going to reiterate that I've seen very little coverage this fall of the Federal Land Freedom Act. You know, a lot of these acts have been introduced before in previous years, and it feels like incremental coverage. But, you know, when pitching these stories, they have a national importance and resonance that you just have to frame for people, for editors first, and then for your readership. But there just hasn't been this sort of attention being paid to bills that are making their way through the House in general. So that's one that I think should be a bigger deal in terms of national coverage than I'm seeing.
Yeah, I think this goes back to the, and I agree with that, and it's not necessarily just the, you know, Freedom from Public Lands Act. It's the, you know, the whole idea of just chipping away at the federal authority, and that is where the battle has moved on public lands. And I think that's a big story, and you can, everything from the budget, you know, to bills like this that transfer management authority, you know, to other things we're seeing is, you know, falls into that narrative, and that's a good story. The other thing, which is, you know, more difficult, is the whole sage-grouse, but I mean, the sage-grouse is a huge deal in the West, and how this comes out is going to be, you know, very, you know, fundamental to what the future of the Endangered Species Act is, as well as what the future of, you know, a bunch of iconic species over 70 million acres.
So for me, we've talked about two of these, but I think they're worth kind of diving into. I'd love to see more coverage on them. And the first is this issue that Zinke's been speaking to a lot lately, which is that oil and gas companies are having a hard time getting permits for drilling on public lands. Like, that's completely false, and I feel like there could be a lot more coverage of that. It's my understanding that 90% of our public lands are open to oil and gas drilling, and there's thousands of unused permits. And so he's getting away with this narrative, and I think pointing out the facts behind that is really important. This issue that he's raised recently about the unloyal civil servants, there's really long-term consequences to that. And I think diving into that a bit more, and Bishop, Congressman Bishop, going after the leakers, and sort of what that's doing to our government, really does have a long-term effect. I've worked in the Department of State and alongside lots of civil servants, and I know bureaucracy is a problem and we tie ourselves in knots often, but these people do the really critical work that makes our government function. So that feels really important. And then lastly, the coastal and marine issues. I feel like we've focused a lot on lands. We're definitely guilty of that. But our waters are in trouble too, and I think we could use some more coverage on that. There's been a lot of talk about increased permits for drilling in the oceans and off coasts, and just I think that's something that could use some more attention.
So I'll add on to what she just said, and then I'll give you something new. So the first one is really on this idea that 30%, you know, within the interior are not loyal to the president, not loyal to Zinke. That's not their job. Well, but he was saying to them, right? I mean, he was saying to them, that's not their job. And if you look at their code of conduct, like there's a piece in there that talks about how they're responsible for upholding the laws of this country and to the Constitution. That's their job. And so I think, you know, I think Coralie said, and these are the people that are on the front lines of conservation every single day. We may not agree with them, you know, all the time, but they're out there, and they're the people that that are entrusted with managing our resources, and so that's who they're really loyal to, is this country and not anybody else. The new thing I will tell you is a lot of what we've been talking today about is exploitation, you know, either for making money or taking it for yourself, right? That's what this idea of like taking back public lands is all about. And so there are some people that want their little pieces of heaven, which I don't disagree with. But when it starts to come down to public access in particular, that's where things get tricky. And so there's a place called the Crazy Mountains in Montana, totally donutted by private land. There's public land, or there's public trails that have been on the books for a long time there that now private landowners are shutting down and not allowing access. So that's happening in Montana. It's happening in Idaho. The Wilkes brothers, who are a couple of Bob and Ferris Wilkes out of Texas, in Idaho, they bought some old timberland, which they can do, but there's a road that has prescriptive easement, which means you can go to that public land that's behind that. They now are patrolling that with like an armed guard saying you cannot be there. And so, yes, you can. And, you know, if you're a hunter going back there to hunt and somebody approaches you, like, you're probably first response to be like, oh, maybe I am in the wrong, right? And so then by de facto, that road starts to get shut down. They've done the same thing in Montana, trying to privatize the Durfee Hills, these brothers. And so this is something that's happening all over the West. And I'm picking on the Wilkes brothers because they're probably the worst actors. But this is happening, and not many people are covering it. And it's like this chipping away again. And once these trails aren't in use, I think it's like for 5 years, you no longer have access. Right, it's like if there isn't that traditional use anymore, and so, you know, they've got lawyers and they're ready to fight the common man. And I think this is a big issue that's facing all of us out in the West.
I got one more for you. I'm assuming that, you know, Glenn Kessler, the fact checker for the Washington Post, is not here, but he should be. And you know, Zinke is stump speech, and if you ever heard a Zinke speech, he gives the exact same speech pretty much every time. The stump speech, part of it is how much money we used to get off the public lands and we're not getting anymore. He talks about in the night when 8 years ago we were getting, you know, $18 billion off the public lands for revenues, and that's down to like $2.5 billion today. And if we could only get that back, all the maintenance backlog in Interior we'd be taken care of, and we'd have $3 billion to spare. Well, there are so many inaccuracies with this. I mean, one, oil was, you know, $150 a barrel back then as opposed to $50 now. Two, money that comes from the revenues off of public lands doesn't go to the Department of the Interior. It goes to the General Treasury, and then Congress has to appropriate it, and Congress has never appropriated enough money for these things. So, I mean, you know, at some point, and he keeps saying this, he doesn't get challenged. At some point, he ought to get challenged on some of the stuff he keeps talking about that is patently untrue.
I'm also going to add. So I think there hasn't been enough coverage of the extent to which a small number of politicians and out of a small number of states are driving Western land policy. I can't remember who said it in one of our stories, but somebody said, you know, I don't want to live in a country run out of Utah. And I think that there hasn't been enough focus on why all of this policy is coming out of Utah. There are some great stories to be done there. You know, you can be first on those too. And I think there are a lot of really well-funded groups that are funding transfer politicians. So that's also a follow the money story that you can make a big splash on.
Well, let's open up to questions. I will repeat them very quickly, but speak up and let us know. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, hi, I'm Nadia White. I'm with the University of Montana. And recently a pretty exhaustive legal examination of the state's legal claim to wildlife was released and then withdrawn from. It's still up, isn't it, Lance?
Yeah.
Martin Nye was the author, but I wondered if you guys saw that at Land and others as a pushback. So this paper challenged the presumption that states own wildlife, which is a big part of a Western approach. Mm-hmm. And is this a push to more clearly establish federal responsibilities on land where there's been some presumption of state oversight? So if you're going to give the public and federal lands to the states, are there areas that have been given that outside groups are now pushing back on to clarify the state federal divide on things like municipal wildlife?
Land, you want to take that one or Whit?
Whit, you can start.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's sort of a, you know, I don't think this is a huge deal. I mean, basically, the way it's worked is that the states have traditionally managed wildlife on federal lands because they are largely, we're talking about game species. and, you know, the states do it on private lands, and those, you know, animals don't recognize the, you know, the difference between, you know, those boundary markers. And that's worked really well in the past. Now, the exception is that the feds manage endangered species, feds manage migratory birds in conjunction with the states. You know, so, I mean, I think that, you know, I don't see anything really nefarious on, you know, what's going on there. I mean, there have been, you know, various interpretations through the, you know, legal theories through the years on this stuff, but I don't see this as a huge deal.
You know, it's a huge deal that they put out that the states manage the wildlife, or that the feds are trying to take the paper down?
Did they terminate Martin's contracts afterwards?
Right, it was a big deal. I mean, I feel like that, I feel like there's an information thing here.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's probably fair, is that you're trying to sort of shut down this dialogue. Yeah, and I think that the, you know, again, I don't think we're spending a lot of time worrying about it, in that, you know, I think that the, you know, the states and the feds work really well together, actually, on wildlife management, and there's not an issue there. And in general, I mean, there are certain exceptions, Alaska, you know, most recently, but, you know, that's an outlier. You know, Lan, do you want to expand on this at all?
I mean, yeah, that's why I had you go first, because then I wouldn't have to talk about it. I mean, I think that, I mean, ultimately that the wildlife belongs to the people, and then it's just managed by different agencies. And I think Whit talked about, you know, like how that's managed. I mean, this goes back to, you know, we formed this country, and I think there was one of those first Supreme Court cases, like 1842, where like instead of like that belonging to the private landowners, that it belongs to the people, right? And so, like, to me, I think that's the fundamental piece. And I think while it's unfortunate that this is trying to be scuttled, like, it's not an issue that I'm that worried about at this point.
Yeah, go ahead. I'm Jeff Turentine from onearth.org. You mentioned the backlash that Jason Chaffetz experienced when he supported the church more than he had to kind of go back and eat crow. If there were a transfer of federal lands to western states, wouldn't the GOP governors or the legislatures also be subject to pressure from outdoorsmen of the hunting cultures and outdoor cultures there that would possibly militate against their selling off these lands to oil and gas? In other words, don't some of those pressures come from the state level just as they were from the federal level?
So the question, just for the tape recording, is if the lands were transferred over to the states, wouldn't there be the same pressure on the states to work with interest groups?
So first thing I would say is look at history, and like we have a report called "Our Public Lands Not for Sale," and it details some western states in there, and I'll give you the most egregious is that Nevada has sold 98% of the lands that were first granted to them when they became a state. I think that's the first piece. The second piece would be exactly what Whit talked about earlier. Federal lands are managed in the majority way for multiple use, right? And they go to a state, it becomes single use, and it's really about making money. And at that point, you know, Elliott State Forest in Oregon, you know, it was an 86,000-acre forest in Oregon that no longer was generating money for the state, and they decided they were going to sell it. Now, did they get a ton of pushback from that? Yes. But do we want to fight every single one of these little battles? No. And I think that ultimately, you know, that's what the states are going to do. And I think that yes, that pressure can be put to bear, but when a state gets in really hard economic times and people are worried about putting a roof over their heads, it's a lot easier to think about selling that land or parcels of that land when they own it. So, and they've proven that happens over time.
Well, and just to elaborate on what Land is saying, I mean, the federal government has the, you know, the beauty or the curse of being able to run deficits. And we do. And, you know, states have got – most of the states balance their budgets every single year. And if you're having – if all of a sudden, say, the price of oil goes from $150 a barrel down to $50 a barrel, and you're faced with a big budget deficit, you have a choice. You can either raise taxes or you can sell off an asset. And you tell me what Western legislature is going to raise taxes as opposed to sell off the asset. I mean, that's what the bottom line is on this stuff. So it doesn't matter how much our community squawks about it. You know, they're not going to change their mind on that.
Look at – I mean, I guess this is something that's going on in Montana right now is that we're running like a $280 million deficit this year. And so they're talking about a special session to raise taxes. Watch that. Absolutely.
So the question, just to repeat it, should we take the sort of the monuments review, essentially, is what the question is, seriously, with the Antiquities Act sort of attached to that?
Well, it's actually about tampering with the Antiquities Act.
Yeah.
So.
gutting the Antiquities Act.
I think it's safe to say that we've never seen threats to public lands like this at this level as much as ever before. And we absolutely should take it seriously. I mean, the monument review process was unprecedented. There are millions of acres of land at stake here. And, I mean, you've already seen, I think, the reaction from state attorneys general, companies like Patagonia, nonprofit groups who are ready for that legal battle because, you know, we think it is illegal for the president to rescind a monument once it's been established. So, yes, I would take it very seriously.
But in these small remote communities near these big public lands, like how much power do the local people have versus, you know, big trade organizations, big environmental organizations?
I mean, Land, your perspective is probably similar to mine, but I think very little, honestly. I mean, these are decisions that are made from upstairs. I mean, there's, you know, local communities are usually often, you know, held up as an excuse for doing one thing or another. And, you know, you'll have Arctic Village on Anwar being held up on by one side. You'll have Kaktovik being held up by another side. You know, they have different opinions about developing the refuge. And I think more often than not, they're used as props as opposed to really taken seriously in this dialogue.
But it's also, I mean, the refuge belongs to all of us, right? And I think that, you know, like we just had some folks up there that went hunting for the first time and, you know, got to go chase some caribou around and catch some Arctic char. And, like, this special place belongs to all of us. And so while I think input is very important from that local level, like, we should be a part of that. And I think, you know, the refuge has been – one of those political footballs has been talked about now for, you know, a long time. And I think as they – as, you know – there's a push to develop it. I think it's, you know, something for American sportsmen in particular, if, from my end, to know what this place is and what it offers. I mean, it's like it's the last frontier, right? I mean, that's what Alaska is called, but this is the last frontier. And if you want to go places to test, you know, your to challenge yourself and to find that grit and just like, I mean, it's an amazing, amazing place. And so, like, I think all American and, you know, sportsmen and women and all Americans should know about it in a real way. Right now, it's like a lot of people don't know about it. And I think the more that do, we'll want to make sure that it's not monkeyed with.
Chris Clayton, I'm with DT and the Progressive Farmer. And I had a lot of feedback from the Public Lands Council over the sage grouse issue back before the agreement was reached. It was going to be the end of grazing as we know it. If there had been a designation of a sage grouse, they came out on Thursday supporting the review. What is the situation like for average rancher on whether it's public lands or private lands in the West because of the sage grouse? Are they facing any real lack of access to land or restrictions?
Yeah, the question is the sage grouse agreement and its impacts on the ranching community. And I think that, you know, the ranch community was definitely in the room, you know, during the whole negotiations. There was a sort of a saying that what's good for the bird is good for the herd. And, you know, so they've, you know, bent over backwards. And I think that, you know, listen, agriculture and grazing is super important in Wyoming. And that's where this agreement was originally developed. And Matt Mead had the, you know, the cattlemen in the room at every step along the way. And, you know, they, I mean, you're going to always find some fringe elements of all these communities that don't like it, either because of real or perceived threats or just they're being used for ideological purposes. But I think, by and large, you know, the grazing community does very well in the sage-grouse agreements, and it's very much in their interest not to have a listing of the sage-grouse, which is why they came to the table. And I think, you know, they were taken care of in this, by and large.
I'd add that, you know, that something that's not been covered that much is that, you know, grazing animal unit months, you know, that are on our federal lands is like $1.65, I think, now. If it gets transferred to the states, that goes up to, you know, 10 something, and if it's private, it's 20, north of 20, like dollars, right? And so this is not necessarily about the sage grouse, but it's about, like, that's a story that has not been covered, and they've been pretty silent about transfer, right? Now, you watch the whole Bundy situation where they didn't, you know, pay for their grazing for years. I think the silence was deafening there, right? You didn't see stock growers come out and be like, oh, we're going to defend the Bundys, you know, because they're getting an amazing deal. Now, what I would love to hear is have them, you know, engage more on that issue. And so I think that's a story that can be told.
Well, I think what's challenging about this actually is that cattlemen's associations and small cattle owners are not necessarily in step on this issue. I mean, you know, the cattlemen's association will be mum on a certain issue, but we also had a wonderful story, I can't remember the writer who wrote it, but about land transfer as it would affect sort of ranchers in Montana over the summer, the story that ran over the summer.
Some people seem to act like they're going to be able to buy, you know, the ranchers will all be able to buy this land, when in reality, probably if they're paying that little for rental fees now, there's absolutely no way they're going to be able to go to a bank and cash flow that kind of
Well, I think it's also interesting from a storytelling perspective to try to sort out the difference between the industry association's representation of the issue and the reality for smaller shareholders who are more diffuse and probably less well represented, but who also have really incredible and significant stories to tell. So,
yeah. Aaron Weiss from the Center for Western Priorities. I've also done a lot of work with all of these guys. My question is for you, Ryan. You talked a little bit about how you kind of stumbled across this as an issue, and Men's Journal pretty quickly became a leader doing some really remarkable enterprise reporting on this. Do you have a sense of, among your readership, why is it that public lands issues pop so much?
I wish I knew the answer. I think it has to do a little bit with the fact that our audience, particularly online, crosses the same sort of boundaries that we were talking about earlier, which is the hunting and fishing community and the recreation community. I think a lot of our readers are mountain bikers at the same time that they're hunters or fishermen. And so they are using these lands probably more than anybody or as much as, you know, a lot of people out west. So I think that was one reason. I also think that this is a strange thing to say, but I also think that it, you know, had to do a little bit with the position of the story. The one story that did really well for us was a story that I wrote, and I sort of, you know, cheekily put the headline as, you know, something like, you know, public lands for sale, exclamation point, you know, here are some of the, you know, whatever, 13 million acres that you can pick up, you know. It was just a listing of places that essentially we would lose, and we did it in a fun way that I think wasn't, you know, it like environmental stories can be dry, and it's a challenge always to be nuanced with them, but at the same time, you know, have a little bit of fun with them when you can, or tell the story in a way that is national in scope, or that that sort of just, you know, does it. And to the reason we continued on that track is, again, it's just we saw the resonance there. So once we saw that one, we started assigning more outside of the building. Again, like the first couple of stories, it was a colleague of mine and I that just said, the hell with it. Like, we're going to do these stories just because we thought it was important. And I think something similar happened at The Guardian as well.
I just add to that? I think there's also, there's some, because I agree, a lot of these stories resonate because you use the land, whether you're a hunter or a hiker or whatever. But I think there's also, we're inherently nostalgic somehow. And so this idea that, like, even if you haven't been outside in 20 years, but one time you did as a child, and like that place is not going to be there anymore, that resonates with people in a really real way. And I think that's a lot of why people who are not engaged in environmental issues are suddenly like, what is happening? This is going on. And people, they might not recognize, we talk a lot about this as like, this is an American heritage that we have, and we're special as a country because of this. And I think that is what hits this idea, like, yeah, it is, and we can't change that. So,
yeah, and I would say that it, you know, it resonates with everybody. Like, this was a global story for us. These were people all around the world who were like, oh, holy shit, they're going to get rid of this? Like, they're going to do that now? So it's you know, it's also a matter of being able to frame these stories with pictures of public lands as opposed to oil derricks. I mean, I think the way you frame what is essentially the same environmental story we've been telling over and over again really matters, and it's a better frame than we've had on other stories.
Yeah, in terms of, you know, why it pops for our community is, you know, this is something that makes America, you know, truly unique. I mean, the public land system here is unrivaled about any place else in the world, and we take it for granted here, but nobody else outside the U.S. takes it for granted. They come to the U.S., and you go to any national park in the summer, and, you know, English is a foreign language. And that's because this is such a uniquely American thing. In terms of the hunting and fishing community, you know, all the way back to Roosevelt, this is something that Roosevelt thought was important, not just for the environment and wildlife stuff like that, but for people to get outside and experience and test themselves against nature. And, you know, that entire, you know, theory has led to a whole different evolution of, say, hunting in this country than in Europe. In Europe, it is a sport for the landed gentry. It is not a sport for the common folk. Here, anybody can do it. So 75% of the hunters in the western U.S. use public lands. Nationally, it's about 50% of the folks who hunt do some or all of the time on public lands. Every headwater, pretty much of every blue ribbon trout and salmon stream in the nation comes from public lands. So it is a direct assault on, you know, essentially hunting and fishing as it is in America today.
I think the only thing I would add is that, like, what happened at MAL here, National Wildlife Refuge, I mean, how long was that in the press? And, like, you know, one of the things that they were talking about, we want to return this to the people. Well, who are the people they're returning to? That's a National Wildlife Refuge that belongs to every single American, right? So I think that with that dialogue, I think that people became more aware of what's going on and that they actually are public landowners of 640 million acres. And so, you know, thank you, Bundys, and that was a horrible thing. But I think people are becoming more aware of it. I think they're complacent a lot, right? Like, those lands are going to be there forever, and that's not the truth. They didn't happen by accident, and they haven't stayed the way they are by accident, and they're not going to go forward by accident either.
So maybe one final question here. Yeah.
Question for Len and Whit. In a sense, I think the people in this room are already in support of public lands. So I just want to, like, highlight the opposition to public lands have a very, very strong framing, right? Their framing is it's state versus federal powers. Another framing is it's the local people in Montana versus these tourists from who knows where, and federal, the big powerful feds, right? So this is very powerful framing that you're coming up against. So how do you address this issue?
Yeah, the question is just, you know, given the way this has been framed by the opponents of public lands as a state versus fed, a local versus fed, you know, the common man versus the bureaucrat, you know, how do we respond back to that? And I think Lands Rath's response was exactly right. I mean, these are lands that belong to everybody and, you know, not to a few. I mean, again, we don't want Utah managing our public lands. And I think that is the fundamental way we come back, that this, these belong to everybody. And listen, there are plenty of problems with how our public lands are managed. Let's have the debate about how we do a better job dealing with, you know, fire, dealing with invasive species, something like that. That's the debate we ought to be having, not whether we ought to have these at all. And I think that, you know, this is, I think the one thing that, and again, I think the Bundys have done us a huge favor of elevating the profile of this issue and, you know, just sort of, you know, presenting the opponents of it as kooks, which they are. And, you know, I think that, you know, it's sort of galvanized people to come around to what is really part of our heritage.
I think the other piece that I would add on is that, you know, all these decisions are made out in Washington, D.C. That's not the truth. Like, you have managers that are on the ground, district managers that are in the communities that are working with people every single day. And if you don't want to participate in those processes, whether that's a resource management plan or a travel management plan, then, like, you're not part of that process, but you can be. I mean, like, that's, like, those decisions are being, I mean, yes, there's some things that come down from D.C. and are top level, but the majority of stuff that's going on the ground that actually has implications is actually happening from people that are in those communities that people know. And so I think, you know, again, they're the stewards of our great public land estate, and those decisions aren't top down. They're coming from things that are happening at a local level.
And if you don't believe that, you know, notice that one of the first things that this administration did when they came in was to eliminate the BLM planning rule that had been developed. The BLM planning rule governed management of 240 million acres and basically increased public input into how those plans are developed, front-loaded that public input so you have less contention at the back end and litigation at the back end. And, you know, eliminating that was a very clear signal that public input in how our public lands are managed is not a priority. In fact, it's something we don't want.
I think also there's another misconception that local communities are against these monuments. I actually don't think that's the case. The polling doesn't work out that way. I think it's a handful of local politicians who are against some of these monuments, not the local communities themselves. Also, you hear often that with respect to monuments, that they were decided really quickly. I mean, that wasn't the case at all for any of these monuments. They took years of work to work with these communities to figure out where the boundaries should be drawn. So this idea that like some bureaucrats in Washington flew into, the Bears Ears area and drew a map. Like, that's not true at all. Bears Ears has been talked about becoming a monument for 80 years. Like, this didn't get established over a couple weeks.
And just in terms of the semantics of framing this story, one of the decisions that we made was to use the word national instead of federal for the sake of our global audience, because federal land means something to a U.S. readership. National land is another way to frame it that actually translates to a global audience and actually sort of breaks the framing of federal versus state or federal versus the people. So I actually like that framing, national lands for federal lands. That's a decision we could make as a community. I would love feedback if you think that's confusing, but that's something that we were trying that seemed to work.
In their stories and help build that narrative that these are public lands that belong to all people. Because so often, especially as you said, new reporters to the beat who haven't been covering it for a long time struggle with that terminology, so they use the same terminology that the federal government uses. And I think it confuses people and it detracts from that local perspective of the story. So I love hearing you say that.
Well, thanks everybody for coming out. This was great. I over time, but yeah.